You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
The story of the UK is an economy that has got real momentum.
What is broken can be repaired. What is ruined can be rebuilt.
UK inflation is becoming much more homegrown.
We have huge potential as an economy in the UK.
This is a time to tell Israel there is a path to peace.
Our plan for the British economy is working, but the work is not done.
You're listening to Bloomberg UK Politics. I'm Stephen Carroll.
And I'm Ewan Potts. Well, it's Prime Minister's Questions Day, but without the Prime Minister, he's in Germany meeting the Chancellor there. This after his big announcement, of course, yesterday in Warsaw that he plans to increase defence spending to 2.5% of GDP by the end of the decade. We're going to be digging into the maths behind that with Ben Zaranko from the Institute for Fiscal Studies a little bit later in the show.
So the deputies are on duty for today's PMQs. Oliver Dowden and Angela Rayner will be facing off in the House of Commons. It'll be interesting to see how much will be said about Angela Rayner's own personal controversy that's been dragging on for a couple of weeks. A police investigation underway into whether Rayner broke electoral law with her living arrangements. Now, she's denied wrongdoing and she's very sure to have her response ready if that comes up in conversation as well. Although you wonder if perhaps the Tories might also not want to dig too deeply down that route because of a recent controversy involving one of their own MPs. That's Mark Menzies, who quit Parliament after allegations were made about his misuse of campaign funds.
Yeah, there's got to be a fair chance that comes up, I think. And I'll be amazed if Oliver Dowden doesn't have some barbs prepared about the Labour's deputy leader. And I'll be equally amazed if Angela Rayner hasn't got a very extremely robust response at the ready when it comes to that attack. Last week, Keir Starmer sought to paint the Tories as fiscally irresponsible. You remember when for their non-pledge pledge, their aspiration to abolish national insurance. So perhaps Angela Rayner will want to keep pushing away that. Or, and I reckon this is quite a sort of Rayner-ish subject, she might want to pick up on rumours of a backtracking on government plans to abolish no-fault evictions for tenants. A lot of Conservative MPs unhappy with that policy. They think that it ties landlords' hands. But I think Labour will be keen to portray the Tories as dropping a key promise to tenants. This was in the 2019 manifesto. A lot of pressure from Tory backbenchers to water down some of these reforms. Lots of pressure from landlords on Tory backbenchers.
Yeah, I mean, that renters reform bill already, many of the key measures being dropped, much to the chagrin of Michael Gove, who's been trying to push it through Parliament as well, so that even within the Tory party, that's something that's been an issue causing some controversy as well. But yeah, Ewan, I think you're right. I think given the fact that we've just had that defence spending pledge and all of the criticism that has come from the maths that have gone into the money or the figures that have been given and where that money might come from, we think there could be plenty more chat about the public finances today. Of course, we had those figures just out yesterday showing that the UK government overshot its borrowing targets for the last fiscal year. That presents a bit of a tighter picture for those going into the election later this year. And of course, the possibility there could be another fiscal event before the election takes place.
Yeah, interesting this debate over defence. Of course, the Labour leader is very keen that he can put some clear water between him and his predecessor on this. Jeremy Corbyn was not keen on increasing defence spending. And Keir Starmer wants to be very robust on the issue. And he said that a Labour government would also aim to get defence spending up to 2.5% of GDP. Rishi Sunak attempting to trump the Labour Party by saying it's now a commitment. By 2030, the UK will spend 2.5% of GDP on defence. But the trouble is, of course, there is very little cash. And that's one of the things we're going to chew over with the Institute for Fiscal Studies later on. The trouble is, if you're going to spend extra money on defence, where is that going to come from? Already, non-protected departments are incredibly squeezed. And the assumption is that more stuff will have to be squeezed if you're going to increase spending on defence.
Yeah, indeed. And look, you know, Rishi Sunak made this announcement in Warsaw. He's in Berlin today, meeting the German Chancellor as well. So there's sort of those big geopolitical issues that he wants to have to the fore as he is present on the world stage, as it were, as Prime Minister. It's a chance for him to step away perhaps from some of the more domestic issues, especially after a week that's been very much focused on his Rwanda deportation bill and when flights will take off after that bill went through Parliament and after a late night session on Monday night. So this is a shift in the narrative that the government is pushing now into focusing on defence. And at a time, you know, of course, we've seen a shift in position for the Labour Party, but that's also because the world has changed rather dramatically in that time too.
Yeah, indeed. And of course, both parties have very little fiscal headroom. You mentioned the possible fiscal event. The Chancellor will be hoping to squeeze another budget in before the election. But the trouble is, all these pledges are narrowing his room, and he's already got very little room when it comes to public spending. So that is something which the Chancellor is going to have to weigh up. And of course, whether we get that fiscal event, it of course depends on whether the election is called in the summer or the autumn. Some rumours that the Tories would like to go in the summer, get it over and done with early. But I think the general consensus is it will still be an autumn election, October or November. And try not to clash too much, of course, with the US election, which is set for early November.
Yeah, indeed. And look, much closer than that, we've got local elections next week, which we may feel come up featured in these Prime Minister's questions as well. Perhaps some more local issues or issues that could be relevant. Some of those key efforts that the Tory party in particular are making to try and maintain some of their regional mayors or metro mayors in the north of England. That's something that we may see some references to, perhaps some local issues there as well, and how that could play into the debate that's happening out there now as politicians at the local level and at the city level are gearing up towards elections too.
Yeah, some fascinating races just a week away. As you mentioned, that Andy Street in the West Midlands, who's been quite a widely respected mayor, a Conservative mayor in the West Midlands, but it's quite difficult to win a big area like that when the Tories are so far behind in the polls. So if you ask people voting intentions across the West Midlands at the moment, regardless of the mayoral election, then you'll find that they will mostly be voting Labour by quite some distance. Whether Andy Street can dodge that bullet and win as a Tory, I think, is quite tricky. And Ben Houchin in the North East will also be another interesting race. More widely, the local elections, it's a relatively small set of local elections, but the ones that the Tories did very, very well at last time. So that makes it particularly difficult for the Tories this time around. They're starting from a very high base, and as we know, they are 20 to 25 points behind Labour in the polls.
Yeah, and this is, of course, as we're going to go to the House of Commons and listen in to Angela Rayner.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And can I first of all share with the Deputy Prime Minister's comments regarding our Jewish community and a happy Passover, and also start by acknowledging the loss of David Markand and Baroness Massey, both of whom made historic contributions in this Parliament, politics and wider life. And also send my condolences following today's news to the family of Lord Frankfield, who is a good friend of mine and a colleague, and who was a tireless campaigner against poverty and a champion for his constituents. Yeah. Mr. Speaker, I know the party opposite is desperate to talk about my living arrangements, but the public want to know what this government is going to do about theirs. Yeah. Natalie from Brighton has been served with two no-fault eviction notices in 18 months. She joins nearly a million families at risk of homelessness due to his party's failure to ban this cruel practice. Now, instead of obsessing over my house, when will he get a grip and show the same obsession with ending no-fault evictions?
Well, to begin with, it is a pleasure to have another exchange with the Right Honourable Lady in this House, our fifth in 12 months. Any more of these, and she'll be claiming it as her principal residence. On the issue of no-fault evictions, it may have escaped the Right Honourable Lady's attention, but we will be voting on exactly that matter later today. The Conservative government taking action.
Mr. Speaker, he clearly thought he could spend all week obsessing over my living arrangements. I didn't even bother to read up on his own government's bill this afternoon. The reality is he caved in to vested interests on his backbenchers and delayed justice for people like Natalie. Yes. This week, the housing minister said there is no solid date for banning no-fault evictions. The housing secretary now says it won't happen before an election. So if he can give us a date, can he name it now?
I can name the date for the right honourable lady. Today. It's today that this House will be voting on it, and I'm confident that in line with our manifesto, we will deliver on that commitment.
Angela Rayner.
Mr. Speaker, he clearly hasn't been looking up on his own government bills. But let me turn to another Tory housing failure. Leaseholds are a rip-off and a con. But the government's proposed ban on new leaseholds applies only to houses. The majority of leaseholds are in flats. What's the point on a ban on new leaseholds if it won't apply to flats?
Again, the right honourable lady is talking about legislation introduced by this government, which the party opposite totally failed to introduce in their entire time in office. And it's no surprise, because it's this government which has brought social housing waiting lists down by nearly 500,000 and delivered more affordable homes in the last year and the last 12 years than Labour delivered when they were in office. But of course, all of this can only be paid for by making sure that we have a strong economy. And I'll tell you, her policy to repeal every single Conservative trade union law in the first 100 days would open the door to French-style wildcat strikes, sweeping away the reforms that made this country great. And we all know, though, Mr. Speaker, the one reform that the Right Honourable Lady would not abolish from Margaret Thatcher, the right to buy your council house.
Angela Rayner.
Mr. Speaker, I was expecting a little bit better from him today. He seems to be a bit worn out. Maybe it's the 3 a.m. calls from the bad men that have been keeping him up at night. But he also, Mr. Speaker, he also talks about strikes and the unions. We've had more strikes under this government's watch than any time before. And once again, he hasn't read his own bill. Their ban on leasehold won't apply to the majority of people. It's like banning non-doms but exempting Tory prime ministers. He speaks about affordable homes. Families are trapped in temporary accommodation and stuck on waiting lists. And in the West Midlands, his mayor has used his multi-million pound housing budget to build just 46 social homes in 8 years. That's almost as many as the Chancellor's property portfolio. But the British people know that his party won't build the homes that this country needs. So when are they going to get a chance to vote for a government that will?
Well, I'm surprised the Right Honourable Lady raises the West Midlands when Labour-controlled Birmingham have virtually bankrupted the council, are hiking up council tax by 21%, whilst in the meantime, and I'm sure this would please her, continuing to hand out 1.8 million to the trade unions. By contrast, Andy Street, our brilliant mayor of the wider West Midlands, has delivered 6.1 billion of investment to improve transport. So there you have it, the contrast between the Conservative Party and the Labour Party. The usual political opportunism from her, failing to ask about the issues that really matter. If you want more bins, if you want more bin collections, more potholes filled, lower debt and lower council tax, vote Conservative, because whether it's Ben Houchen in the Tees Valley or whether it's Andy Street in the West Midlands, it's only the Conservative mayors who deliver more for less.
Well, Mr. Speaker, that's pretty revealing that he thinks that housing isn't an issue for the British people, because I think it really is. And people in glasshouses shouldn't throw the stones, because in Birmingham and across the whole of this country, councils are facing black holes because of his government's austerity programme. And I would also warn the Deputy Prime Minister that Tory councils have also faced 114 notices. A Birmingham council has had over £1 billion taken from their budget from some of the poorest people. More than 16,000 families face losing their homes after the party's mini-budget, Mr Speaker, and mortgage bills continue to soar. Yeah. Meanwhile, the former Prime Minister parades around the world in a twisted victory lap promoting her new book, saying that the mini-budget was her proudest moment. So since she won't apologise to those families losing their home, will he?
Well, what the Prime Minister has done since he has taken office with the Chancellor is to restore stability to our economy, inflation halved and more down to 3%. And as a result of that, in an increasingly dangerous world, the Prime Minister was able to announce his plan for the biggest strengthening of defence spending in a generation. But it should come as no surprise that the party opposite refused to say whether they back it or not. Because this comes from the Right Honourable Lady, who voted to scrap Trident and install in Downing Street someone who wanted to change the army into a Peace Corps. There you have it.
Mr Speaker, defence, we all want to see 2.5%. The difference is that we haven't cut the army to its smallest size since Napoleon. And Mr Speaker, never mind some secretive deep state. Never mind some secretive deep state. It's the state of the Tory party that's the problem. They're in a deep state of sewerage. After 14 years, they failed renters, they failed leaseholders, and they failed mortgage holders. But, Mr Speaker, I read with interest that the Right Honourable Gentleman has been urging his neighbour in Number 10 to call an election because he's worried they might get wiped out. Has he finally realised that when he stabbed Boris Johnson in the back to get his mate into Number 10, he was ditching their biggest election winner for a pint-sized loser?
I think the whole House will have heard, despite all the bluster from the lady opposite, not a single word on whether she would actually back our plans to invest in our armed forces. No plans in a dangerous world. And of course, as ever, the Deputy Leader is always looking to attack others' failures, but never the one to take responsibility for her own. She once said, "You shouldn't be waiting for the police to bang on your door. If you did it, then you shouldn't be doing your job." The Right Honourable Landlady should forget her tax advice and follow her own advice.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. And levelling up
that
on
was
my friend,
this week's earlier. Prime Minister's questions. Angela Rayner there, and the Deputy Prime Minister Oliver Dowden standing in, as we've been discussing. Rishi Sunak is away in Germany on part of his tour of Eastern Europe, as we had that announcement around defence spending. You and I think we deserve to clap ourselves in the back there for hitting so many of the issues that we'd expected. So, to be fair to Angela Rayner, it was her that brought up first the police investigation into her living arrangements, but used that as a pivot to focus on the Renters Reform Bill, something else that you'd mentioned in advance of this as well. We even saw some discussion of the promise to increase defence spending, as we've been talking about. And local elections as well, yes, mention of some of the campaign promises of some of the candidates too. It was a bit, in terms of style, I mean, it wasn't, you could tell they don't do it all the time.
Well, quite frankly, I thought it was disappointing. Because we've had some really good Prime Minister's questions with the two deputies. They can be really combative. You know, they're both quite good performers. But I just thought both of them were on pretty weak form today. Angela Rayner fluffed her lines a few times. Some of Dowden's jokes landed a bit flat. It just felt like they were both kind of reading off carefully prepared notes and not really doing it very well. So I think it was a bit of a letdown, really. Some of the jokes were quite well written and just really badly delivered. So I think it was a disappointment.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure the comment about the Prime Minister's height was necessarily very...
That was pretty brutal.
...decorous either, frankly, but that's an issue for another day. It, of course, worth pointing to the Renters Reform Bill and the votes happening in Parliament as that being one of the significant policy issues that's being discussed today. But let's get back to where we started the programme, which is this promise from the Prime Minister to increase the UK's defence spending to 2.5% of GDP by 2030. Now, he says that amounts to an extra £75 billion over the next 6 years. This is an issue that both parties have talked about where defence spending should be. But the questions now are, is where is the money coming from? We spoke about this to Ben Zaranko, who's a senior economist at the Institute for Fiscal Studies. Let's take a listen to what he had to say.
I don't think it's a terribly helpful way of framing and describing what is a big and significant announcement and an important one that we should be discussing. But the government's sort of overstating the scale of its promise, if you like. It's the £75 billion number effectively does two things. One, it assumes that no extra money would have gone into defence at any point over the next 6 years. And so it assumes that spending would otherwise have remained constant in cash terms. It would have broken our NATO promises. And then secondly, it then adds up all of the increases over that six-year period to give them the biggest possible sounding number. I think a more reasonable number might be to say we'd be spending an extra £7 billion by 2030 each year, or maybe about 20 or 25 billion over six. But £75 billion, not terribly helpful.
So essentially, the calculations have been slightly skewed to make that number look bigger. So your estimate for the cost, if the government is to increase spending to 2.5% of GDP by 2030, how much should that cost by then, in addition to what's already expected?
Well, a little bit depends on that last point there. It depends on what you think would have happened anyway. I think at a minimum, we might have expected the government to continue to spend 2% of GDP on defence, which is what we promised to do as a NATO member, what the UK has done historically. So if you take that as your starting point, then the cost is considerably, it's still considerable. You're looking at maybe £16 or £17 billion by the final year. If you instead take as your starting point that we'd have kept defence spending where it is now, where it's a little bit higher because of the extra spending we've been doing in Ukraine, then it costs about £7 billion in the final year. Now, both of those are big numbers, but you'll notice they're both a lot smaller than 75.
We know that whichever government is in power next year is going to have a very, very tight fiscal window. There's not a lot of money to spend on anything. What would this extra spending mean for the rest of the government's finances, for the rest of public spending?
Well, when he announced this new promise yesterday, Rishi Sunak was very clear that it wouldn't involve any extra borrowing or any extra debt. So he's implicitly saying it's going to come from within the exact same spending plans. There's no extra money. We're going to find it from somewhere else. Now, there's been far less detail on where that somewhere else might be, but it means that a set of spending plans that were already looking quite tight for the post-election period now look even more so. So once you take account of this promise, promises on childcare, the NHS and other areas, everything else, so things like local governments, councils, your prisons, further education colleges, those areas are facing some really quite deep cuts after 2025, about maybe 4% per year, which is about two-thirds of the rate we did during the peak of the austerity years in the 2010s. So doing that when lots of those services are showing signs of struggling really quite a lot, that's a big, big challenge awaiting the next government. And conveniently, the spending review where all those decisions will need to be ironed out isn't due to happen until after the election. So it may well end up being someone else's problem.
That's interesting. So ballpark, two-thirds of the spending cuts we got during the austerity years for unprotected departments. I just wanted to just quickly ask you about the childcare commitment, because this is a new spending commitment, isn't it, in the spring budget? And this is a lot of money, isn't it?
The childcare promises are quite big in terms of the proportional expansion of how much we spend on childcare, but they are not enormous in the grand scheme of some of these defence promises, for example. So it's about an extra ballpark $5 billion a year on childcare, which is a big sum, and it's going to be a big thing for lots of working parents who now get this big subsidy. But that's not really what's driving the tightness of these plans. I think the biggest area of public spending, single biggest area, is the NHS. And I think that the reality of having an aging population and this plan to rapidly increase the size of the NHS workforce means that there's going to be lots of extra money going in there, which will mean not much else for anywhere, any other budgets. And if you're also going to be ramping up defence spending and you're adding new childcare commitments, basically expanding the welfare state, there's some very tough choices left for everything else. And I think a bit more clarity about the party's visions for that might not be electorally wise, but would be sensible for setting out their vision for the future of the country.
Now, the government have said that they intend to pay for this extra defence spending by shrinking the bill for civil servants by roughly 30%. Is it reasonable to expect to be able to save billions of pounds from doing that?
I think the government said they want to save about £3 billion yesterday by cutting the size of the civil service. Now, the civil service has expanded a lot, particularly since Brexit, and then again after the pandemic, after some quite big cuts during the 2010s. So it's not a ridiculous thing to want to cut back the size of the civil service and undo some of that recent expansion. Now, of course, you have to then decide where to cut it from. A lot of civil servants are what we might think of as frontline staff, whether it's working in an HMRC call centre to deal with the tax query or running a job centre. And so it'd be nice to see more detail about where they see those cuts coming. But I think that the idea that you can just magic up the money for a major expansion in defence spending by cutting back a couple of civil servants, which is something they've said they wanted to do anyway, doesn't really reckon with the scale of what's going on here and isn't really a serious way of engaging with this unfortunate new reality we have, which is the world's more dangerous. We need to spend more on defence. And the only way to do that sustainably is to raise taxes or cut back on something else that the state currently does. I don't think you can magic that away through efficiency savings.
Of course, the other way out, which both parties talk about all the time, is growing GDP. If growth magically takes off and we return to averaging, say, 3% growth a year, and I won't ask you whether you think that's likely or not, but how far would that get us out of the government's spending hole?
That would help a lot. Now, on defence, actually, it's worth noting that given that the promise is to spend 2.5% of GDP on defence, if you grow GDP, you have to spend more on defence. But even taking that aside, it would definitely make things easier if you could manage to deliver growth somehow. Obviously, it's easier said than done, but it would ease a lot of these constraints, ease a lot of these trade-offs, and really help to get out of this fiscal bind the next government will find themselves in. But I think that banking on that extra growth, when it's no, we don't know with any certainty that we can deliver it. If we knew how to do it, we'd probably already have done it, would be an unwise and a risky move to take. I think we have to absolutely aim to undertake policies that might boost our growth potential, but we can't bank that money before it's materialised.
So that was Ben Zaranko, senior economist at the Institute for Fiscal Studies, speaking to us a little bit earlier, laying out pretty clearly, I think, you and the difficulty in making promises like this in the first place, never mind the specific sums involved in this particular pledge from the Prime Minister, but showing that, you know, no matter who's going to be in government after the next election, it's going to be a very constrained situation they face when it comes to finances.
Yeah, for sure. And I think defence is unlikely to be one of the big issues in the general election. It's normally one of those issues which sort of bubbles up down below. But Labour making very clear that they're not going to allow the Tories to hit them over the head as they have in the past. It's been an issue which the Tories have quite often attacked Labour on. And Keir Starmer's attempting to be very clear that the Labour government also wants to spend more on defence. They want to spend 2.5% like the Conservatives, but it is just an aspiration. But interesting that Angela Rayner said the Tories have cut the army to its smallest size since Napoleon. So that was her attack line on defence.
Okay, so that was today's episode on Prime Minister's Questions. If you like the programme, don't forget to subscribe. Give it 5 stars so other people can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
This episode was produced by James Walcock, and our audio engineer was Sean Gostomachia. I'm Ewan Potts.
And I'm Stephen Carroll. We'll be back with more tomorrow. This is Bloomberg.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.